Hello and welcome to Still Any Good, the podcast where we run the risk of ruining our childhoods by revisiting fondly remembered films. My name's Christopher Webb, and will you please welcome someone who could eat a peach, or any other soft fruit for that matter, for hours. It's Robert Johnson.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, how's it going?
Good, thank you, good. I could eat a peach for hours, it'd have to be probably Roald Dahl's giant peach for it to take that long, but
you'd have to cut it up very small to go on for hours, because it is very soft. It would dissolve.
It would. But yes, a classic line from the film that we're about to talk about.
Yeah, so should we just get straight to it? I think everyone's probably guessed.
This is a film that I was 16 when it came out back in 1997. It's crazy to think it's 22 years old. Very popular action film, sort of a peak 90s action blockbuster, bringing together two giants of the screen who are really both going through quite an amazing time in their respective careers at this time. Of course, I'm talking about the John Woo action film Face/Off.
I've been chasing this guy ever since I joined the force. He has no conscience, and he shows no remorse. He's the mastermind behind numerous bombings and political assassinations. He has a felony list a mile long: murder, arson, kidnapping, terrorism, you name it. He's the most dangerous and brilliant criminal mind I've ever known. For years, I've been watching him, tracking him, studying his every move. I know his every mannerism, facial tic, gesture. I know him better than he knows himself. And now, after all this time, I finally figured out a way to trap him. I will become him.
You're not having any fun, are you, Sean? Try terrorism for hire. We'll blow some stuff up. It's more fun.
Plan B. Let's just kill each other.
So why did you choose Face Off, Robert?
So I remember seeing this at the movies. Like I said, I was 16 years old when it came out. Probably pretty much the target demographic for this kind of film. Big fan of both Travolta and Cage at the time, but also John Woo, who directed it. Mm-hmm. I went to it with my friends. We just really loved it. You know, we'd gone to Broken Arrow the year before, which was, of course, sort of directed by John Woo, starring John Travolta. Mm-hmm. This was a period of time I like to call the Travolta Renaissance, where he'd had that dream run of Pulp Fiction in 94, Get Shorty the year after, Broken Arrow the year after that, and then this.
You forgot Michael, which came just before.
Oh, God. Yeah, no, I didn't forget Michael. I deliberately omitted it. And of course, at the same time, this was the holy trinity of Cage. The 2 years where he did three peak 90s bombastic action classics. After winning the Oscar, of course, and with Leaving Las Vegas in 1995, where he'd been an indie movie kind of darling for years. And he decided he wanted to have some fun and get a paycheck, and did The Rock in 96, which that's a contender for this podcast at some point. And then in 1997, he did Face Off and Con Air. Mm. Three emblematic of the 90s action films.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and then again, of course, you know, John Woo, who was a legend in Hong Kong action filmmaking at this point. He had done, of course, A Better Tomorrow, Hard Boiled, The Killer, a kind of icon of the genre that they call heroic bloodshed. Yeah, which is a Hong Kong invented genre, which involved kind of things that John Woo is famous for: stylized action, really dramatic kind of themes like brotherhood, honor, redemption, lots of blood, lots of action, the gun-fu action technique that he invented, which is the cool, you know, two guns leaping through the air, which has really become it's become a total parody thing. Yes. Now, but there was a period of time where it was just unironically cool, and he had invented that. And so it was like a coming together of these titans of the screen, and getting the opportunity to see Travolta impersonate Cage and vice versa. I mean, what more could you ask for?
We will talk about that, most definitely.
So I really enjoyed this as a teen. I remember there was, you know, hiring out many times the few years after that, but then probably haven't seen it for like a good 15 years. That kind of 90s overblown bombastic action film kind of fell out of favor. Yeah, so I just thought, why not revisit this? Have you seen this before?
Yeah, the last time I saw it was probably about 10 years ago. I think it was on TV, so I recorded it, watched it, had some good laughs while watching it, but don't recall going to see it at the movie, so probably saw it when it came out on VHS the following year. I do remember thinking how overblown and ridiculous and just fun that it was at the time. This was when Nicolas Cage started enjoying himself and doing some of that really crazy nonsense. And like you said, John Travolta was still pretty cool.
Yeah.
He still had it in his contract at the time that I think he has to do a little dance in every film that he was in. That probably stopped around about Primary Colors, something like that. I don't know. I've not seen that many John Woo films. I've seen Hard Boiled.
Yeah.
Obviously seen Mission Impossible 2, which is just a cartoon, and this one, and that's probably about it. But they're all very similar with those trademarks.
They're very similar, the trademarks, the slow-mo action. He likes a sort of emotional characterization and kind of drama mixed with the very kind of elaborate action and slow-mo gunplay. Things like, he likes having doves. He likes sort of white doves.
Yeah, there's doves, yeah, or white pigeons, as I believe they're called. Yeah.
He basically just got a whole lot of standard pigeons and spray painted them white.
That's why Mission Impossible 2 overran, is because it just took so long to tip-ex the pigeons.
Yeah, Mission Impossible 2, of course. He likes working with Scientologists.
Ah, yes.
There was a crap Ben Affleck one that he did as well. It was based on a Philip K. Dick.
Paycheck, which is a crap title.
Well, it really says it all, doesn't it? The title, they're both.
I have seen that one actually. I'd forgotten completely about that.
Yeah, I think he's gone back to his kind of roots in recent years, John Woo. If I may be making this up, but I seem to recall him going back to kind of doing more of the Hong Kong cinema.
Okay.
Yeah, I think this was, you know, he'd done Hard Target a few years earlier with Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Ah, okay.
Obviously Broken Arrow the year before, which was a commercial success, got some mixed reviews. It was
Christian Slater, isn't it?
Yeah, Travolta was playing a baddie. It was quite a hammy, typical Travolta baddie role. Christian Slater was the good guy. But apparently on this film, Face Off, he was given a lot of creative freedom to really make it in his style, execute it the way he wanted to do it. And I think that kind of comes across throughout the film. Which, of course, opens with this very dreamy credit sequence where John Travolta is on a carousel with his son, Mikey.
He's slobbering over him, yeah.
They're having a great time. Well, Travolta is. Not sure how the kid can be after, you know, being drilled on. In the distance, an evil Freddie Mercury turns up.
I thought he looked like Finchy.
Nicolas Cage with like a little slug moustache.
Yeah, like Blakey.
Yeah. And he sets up a sniper rifle, the dirty rotter, and shoots Travolta through the back, of course, penetrates him and kills the kid.
Not before, of course, John Travolta does the first of many of that alien face hugger thing that he does throughout the whole of the film.
Yeah, the little finger all over your face and sort of
just smear. He's obviously trying to wipe the slobber off the child's face.
Yeah, what they should have shown first was him actually farting in his hand. And be like, oh, Dad, stop it. How don't you do that?
Yeah. So, yeah, the bullet, as you said, goes through Travolta and kills Mikey.
Yeah.
And while Travolta's crawling around screaming, did you notice that everybody else doesn't pay any attention to them at all? They're all just going about their day at the fairground. Yeah. No one's going to lose their place in the queue.
Yeah, I don't know what a typical day at that fairground is if no one bets a night, someone getting shot in the carousel. Those carnies. Did you notice this, though? Cage shoots Travolta and it shows a blood splatter on the kind of horse that they're riding on the carousel?
Yes.
Did you notice that it neighs?
No.
They show the blood on the horse and then you hear this.
I must have missed that. I was too busy going, no!
Yeah, I played it twice just to kind of make sure I wasn't having the oral hallucination. It was interesting. It was almost like the knight's kind of white steed, you know, kind of neighing in anguish.
That's astonishing.
Yeah, interesting move there, Woo.
So then we immediately go to 6 years later. Yeah. Much time has passed.
Indeed.
and we learn that John Travolta's character, Sean Archer, is a big knob in the FBI.
Yeah.
And he's made it his sole purpose to capture Nicolas Cage's character, Castor Troy, the man who killed his son.
I mean, those names as well. I mean, that's Castor Troy, and of course we find out he has a brother, Pollux. And Sean Archer.
Yeah, the Archer, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've thought about it.
I mean, it's setting these two up as these mythic demigods of good and evil in this battle of good and evil. Not very subtle, but yeah.
They should have called them Rocky and Apollo, shouldn't they, really?
Yeah. Rocky and Ivan. If he dies, he dies.
But, of course, as they're saying, We believe that Castor Troy's in town, even though the $1 billion intel doesn't tell us that he is and all this stuff.
Yeah.
John Travolta's right. Sean Archer's correct. And it cuts to Nicolas Cage, Castor Troy, dressed as a priest while setting up a bomb. This was for the ultimate set the timer for a long way away to allow things to happen. It's to go off in 263 hours. It's unbelievable. Normally it's a day, something like that. But
very specific, isn't it?
Yeah, 263. Which, of course, then leads straight into one of the first of many memorable scenes in this film, where there's a choir in this big sort of conference hall where Castor Troy has planted the bomb to prove that he's really inconspicuous and nobody's going to notice that he's a terrorist dressed as a priest. He starts sort of twerking. and then he gropes a child and does this incredible O face while he's doing it, this kind of sort of face.
It's very gif-able as you've...
I did use it in preparation for this, yeah.
Yeah, he says Messiah is fucking boring, and the child that he's about to grope, of course, she even makes a hack-like handle sound good. So
that's right.
Let's give him the benefit of the doubt and say she was 18.
Yes, let's do that.
Nicolas Cage really chewing the scenery here, going full, I think, self-described nouveau shamanic is the acting style.
Just call it full Cage.
Yeah.
So he after planting the bomb, he then goes to the airport because he wants to make a quick getaway. And this is where we meet his brother, Pollux, played by Alessandro Nivola.
Yeah.
Who's, of course, meant to be the geeky, slightly disassociated one. Because he wears glasses and he dresses a bit funny. He's not handsome underneath that at all. What did you think of Nivola's performance?
It was a very mannered. Yeah, he's sort of like this eccentric, kind of on the spectrum. Slightly, you get the impression he's a bit of a deviant. Can't tie shoelaces. I found it quite irritating, to be honest.
Yeah, I thought he was pretty poor.
Yeah.
Because I've seen him in other films, and he doesn't talk like this, does throughout the whole of the film.
Yeah.
Sex sandwich. He doesn't talk like that, really.
You know what I think is, he saw Nicolas Cage absolutely chewing every ounce of scenery in the shot. He saw Travolta later on doing the Cage thing, also hamming it up big time, and he thought, you know what, I can be a ham too. I can play with the big boys. And he just can't.
It's like a delicatessen, the amount of ham on show, isn't it?
Exactly. That's why the poster had Cage Travolta, not Cage Travolta Nivola.
There's a reason, yeah.
There's a reason.
The other thing I noticed is, I think this film has got probably the noisiest coats that I've ever heard in a film.
But, you know, I really love that scene where Castor Troy drives up onto the tarmac, gets out of the car, and his coat is billowing in the wind. It's almost like an anime
thing,
and it's just so, you know, you just can't get away with it now. You could get away with it in the mid-90s. He just looks cool and iconic and like a badass.
It's stylish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very stylish. And now it would just be played for comedic effect if you tried to do something like that in a movie. You know, the other thing that really struck me was how skinny these guys are.
Yeah.
Do you know John Travolta's 65 now?
So I believe, yeah. And Nicolas Cage must be about 60.
He must be. He just looks so lithe and athletic and young and They look great.
They were probably older than Wilford Brimley when he was in a film where he looked a bit older than the rest of them, which is what every fucker says.
Yeah, yeah. They should remake Cocoon, actually, now with Travolta and Cage. It'd be great.
Cocoon?
Yeah, you know.
Cocoon. Little callback there. So Castor Troy, he's given like a Cadbury's Heroes of drugs. Yeah. They open this box room and it's full of his favourites. There's like Maltesers, which everyone goes for first, and the Cherry Ripe that nobody likes. It's all in there.
Some big fat doobies.
Absolutely. Mm. And he's welcomed onto the private plane by a lady.
Yeah. He's got quite a pickup line, isn't he?
Yeah. Of course, he says, a peach. I could eat a peach for hours. And he's like, Jesus. But of course, he then follows that with, what would you do if I was to let you suck my tongue?
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh, God, would you be grateful? I just had my lunch. That's horrible.
I was kind of relieved because there was a pregnant pause between suck my. I was just relieved he said tongue, to be honest.
Yeah, he's cheeky, eh?
Yeah, yeah. And she does, though.
She does, yeah. Quite horribly.
Yeah, quite graphically sucks the tongue.
Hmm. But that's when the police turn up and the feds. They're chasing this plane down a runway. There's helicopters, there's trucks. There's a game of chicken with Sean Archer and the aeroplane. And that's when the tongue-sucking stewardess reveals herself to be an FBI agent.
Yeah.
Not a very good one. She just drops her gun when he throws something at her.
Basically.
She sort of goes, eek, and drops her gun.
But I thought this was quite a cool little sequence, actually. Like you say, I mean, it's totally over the top. There's just a whole lot of stunt driving, helicopters. It's just carnage on the tarmac. Little known sequel to Sophie Ellis Bextor's Murder on the Dance Floor, Carnage on the Tarmac.
good to blow this goddamn plane right up.
I got very nostalgic, actually, kind of watching some of these action sequences.
Oh, yeah. It's such good fun. Mm. The set pieces in this are just fun.
Yeah.
And I think we'll talk about that a lot more as we go along, but very enjoyable. Like we said, totally ridiculous, totally overblown, but that's the point.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of shooting out of planes, out of helicopters. The tongue-sucking stewardess gets thrown out of the plane and gets squashed.
It's
very unpleasant.
It's very unpleasant, that. Yeah. It's almost played for
and
a
laugh.
And
then he shoots the pilot. Yeah, the pilot says he doesn't want to take off, so he shoots him, which is almost literally shooting yourself in the foot, really.
He's a horrible guy.
He's a bad man, yeah. Mm. The plane crashes into a hangar. As Castor Troy is then diving out of the plane in slow motion, he manages to shoot one of the feds in the ear.
Yeah. He must have thought the movie was called Ear Off at that point.
Nice. So Pollux is very quickly arrested, and Castor's running away from Archer, and he hides in this big room.
Yeah.
Where there's a lot more shooty, explodey, explodey.
Yeah.
They have a standoff, the first of one of their standoffs, where they're pointing the guns at each other.
Stand forward slash off.
Yeah. And then something kind of happens with a big engine.
It was quite cool, this bit where they have their little fight, and then Travolta kicks them into the jet engine. And he's blown way down the shaft of that thing.
Yep, he's smashed into a fence.
That was a really cool bit, I thought.
It's good, yeah.
Yeah.
So he's caught, and then we're straight to the Archer home, where we meet Joan Allen, who's playing dowdy, unsatisfied housewife again.
Yeah.
She was 40 when they made this. So why did they make her up to look like she's 60?
I don't know. But it's quite a thankless role for her, wasn't it? Because she had quite a good career for a while there.
Oh, absolutely. She's Oscar nominated. I forget what for, but she has been Oscar nominated.
Was it for The Contender? Yeah, that Jeff Bridges when he was the president?
It might have been. Yeah, so we meet the remainder of the Archer family, which is his daughter, Jamie, who is your stereotypical rebel teenage daughter. She's wearing dark-coloured makeup and has a piercing. And says, oh, hate you, don't care.
Yes, played by Dominic Swain, who kind of...
That's right, Lolita.
Yeah, she was the remade Lolita and hasn't really done much. Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think so. But the big celebration is that I got him, Eve. So that's his way of saying that he's arrested. He believes Castor Troy to be dead.
Yeah, and he can finally stop the last 6 years of living in post-traumatic stress disorder, being a terrible husband, terrible father, single-mindedly, obsessively pursuing this terrorist. Yeah.
But it doesn't stop him smearing his farty hand all down her face. That's still there. He does that once more.
She barely contains the disgust. But he says, you know, hey, look, I'll get a desk job. You know, I'll go to counselling, whatever you want. It's going to be turning a new corner in their obviously shitty marriage.
So he basically says, I don't really mind as long as you get your hand out of my face. That's what I want.
Yeah, as long as he stops stink palming me.
I'm going to call it that for the rest of the recording. Stink palm. That's great. And then we're back in the FBI office where it's one of those typical scenes where somebody walks in and someone starts a slow hand clap.
Yeah.
And they're all, woo, yeah, woo. They give him a bottle of champagne.
And he's an absolute prick.
Yeah, just for once, just pretend that it's good. But of course, he makes them all feel guilty for being happy by reminding them of the people who've fallen in the line of duty. So it's like, to Anderson, Montgomery, Berkeley.
Pincus?
Pinkos, Greenos, Brownos, Goldos.
What a jerk. Everyone's just trying to celebrate after, you know, a job well done. And but yeah, it's hilarious when he's like, what about Anderson, Montgomery, Berkeley? And then he pauses and Pincus?
Yep. Pincus.
Janelli, Winters. It's like, yeah, wow. Way to bring us down by just reminding us of all our dead co-workers.
You utter prick.
Yeah.
But this is, of course, when he finds out that there's the possibility of a bomb, because they find a floppy disk with bomb stuff on it.
Yeah, that was a blast from the past, seeing that floppy disk handed over.
Yeah, I know. They probably had it hidden in his file of facts.
Yeah, and we learn that the type of bomb that it is, depending on prevailing winds, we could have a situation worse than Gulf War syndrome. So, yeah.
Pretty bad.
Yeah, especially if the winds are prevailing.
If they're not, it'd be fine.
Yeah, if it's a calm day, then look.
Bearing in mind what their plan is to actually solve this crisis, it would be a much more sensible plan just to buy a giant fan.
Yeah, exactly.
And make your own prevailing wind. Just a giant Pifco.
They know that, you know, the only person who can really, who knows where this bomb's located is Pollux. And the only person he had talked to is his brother, and he's dead.
Well, actually,
we learn there is one other possibility.
Yeah.
And it's the obvious.
I'm surprised it never occurred to Sean Archer first, to be fair.
Yeah.
So they take Archer to a special medical facility. You can tell it's expensive because they're wearing purple scrubs. That's always a sign that they've gone private. It's not NHS.
Not out of where the kind of the bluey green.
No, absolutely not. No,
we've got to go purple.
This isn't for public. Yeah, this is purple scrubs. Very expensive.
Yeah.
Where they meet a clever scientist, Comfiore.
Yeah, Comfiore.
And they reveal that he's still alive. They're keeping him alive.
Yeah, Sean Archer's really hacked off to see that. But it's okay because he's a turnip. And they demonstrate this by stubbing out a cigarette on him.
If they're prepared to do that, they'd be prepared to waterboard Pollux Troy to get the information they want.
You'd think so. Why don't they try? Yeah, because they try torturing the gang.
Well, he throws him over a table.
He makes another guy shit his pants.
He does. How do you do that?
I don't know. Force feed him laxatives? I'm not sure.
Yeah. Just a very hot curry. But of course, when in the interrogations, that's where we meet the rest of the gang.
Mm-hmm.
So we meet, I forget any of their names, but we meet Gina Gershon.
Yeah, well, you know you're in a 90s film if Gina Gershon pops up.
And she has a child, so Sean plays a bit dirty and says, right, if you don't tell me, we'll put your child in care. And then we also meet, I forget his name, but it's the baldy one, played by Nick Cassavetes.
Yeah, her brother, who she has a bit of an inappropriate relationship with.
Yes, there's a lingering kiss later on, isn't there? Yes. Yeah. These terrorists, they'll do anything, they really
And are. He, under sort of duress, he reveals that he knows the date that the bomb is supposed to go off, but that's it.
Yeah.
And they let him walk off. Yeah, okay, thanks for that. They let him walk away. Surely...
Yeah, off you go. Off you go.
Surely that's a reason to kind of maybe detain him.
Yeah, because if you were Castor or Pollux, you wouldn't go to him and say, it's going to go off on the 12th of April. Not going to tell you where.
Yeah, yeah.
Not going to tell you how. Just then.
I wonder if they didn't actually tell him the date and they just said, look, it's going to be in 263 hours.
That's right.
And he was like, ooh, you've set me a really good puzzle there. That'll take me a while, but I'll work it out.
Yeah, it's just a maths quiz. But Nick Cassavetes, he's a director now, isn't he? He directed The Notebook.
Oh, did he? So I presume he's the son of...
He's John's son and Gina Rowland's son, yeah.
Okay.
Because here's a bit of trivia. Before the Marvel avalanche, he was the first director signed up for Iron Man when it was first being written.
That's interesting. Instead, we got Hacky Favreau.
Hacky Favreau, yeah. I think it went into Turnaround and he did The Notebook instead.
Both pretty iconic films, different ways.
Yes, absolutely. But anyway, back at the hospital, Sean knows that Castor Troy's alive, and now they reveal their superb plan, which is to take off Castor Troy's face and stick it on John Travolta's head.
Well, to be fair, to stick it on his face, otherwise that wouldn't quite work. Like a little hat.
That's right. They should put it on the back. Yeah, it would have been great.
Yeah, it could have been like Voldemort in the first Harry Potter.
Yes.
But we do find out as well that, you know, this is a black bag operation, strictly off the books. So no one's going to know.
That always ends well.
Yeah. Because apparently this film inspired Infernal Affairs, the Hong Kong action film, which of course then was the basis for The Departed.
That's right.
Yeah. There are the echoes there where, you know, kind of only one or two people knew about DiCaprio's undercover operation, and then once they're taken out, he's kind of stuck.
He's alone, yeah.
Yeah.
I think The Departed would have been so much better if they'd swapped faces.
Oh, it would have been. Brilliant. Yeah, Matt Damon doing a DiCaprio and DiCaprio doing a Damon.
It would have been brilliant. To be fair, I think any film would be improved if the protagonist and the antagonist swapped faces.
What I love about this is it's such a ridiculous high concept, and it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. There's no getting around it, but they just totally go with it, and they somehow create kind of an internal logic and mood within the film that it feels right to have, like, grown men's faces sliced off. And
yeah, it almost suggests the "we're not so different, you and I."
Oh, there's plenty of that. Yeah. We've become so obsessed with each other that no one knows the other as much as we do, and we're two sides of the same coin. And then, of course, there's the whole the evil terrorist actually makes a better husband to the neglected wife than the super cop does. And the super cop makes a better father figure to the terrorist child than that's not that much of a leap, really. But, yeah.
No, that's a tricky one. But, yeah, you're right. I think it does make sense in the context of the film, even though, as you said, it's a completely preposterous idea, because everything else that happens is ridiculous. So it doesn't feel out of place.
Exactly. It feels kind of cartoon come to life.
Yeah, and absolutely.
I quite like, you know, it's set in the present day, but it's got these sort of sci-fi trappings. So, you know, kind of like the face swap is a bit of a slightly sci-fi element. The kind of special prison that they go to that we see later in the film, that's kind of like a little bit sci-fi. It just kind of creates this different kind of heightened reality of the film, which I quite like.
Oh, completely. And it's just accepted at, pardon the pun, at face value.
Yeah.
What I did like is the effort that they made to correct the fact that these actors have got completely different builds, completely different hairlines. There's a little excuse for everything. The height difference is negligible. Which apparently it is. I didn't realise John Travolta's taller than Nicolas Cage.
Well, he's quite a big man, John Travolta, but he's also, like you allude to, he's got at least 15 kilos of sort of paunch on Cage. Yeah. And then, conversely, Cage's widow's peak is a receding hairline there.
And so they do something with the hairlines. Yeah. They
laser off the hairline? Like, couldn't you just trim it?
Laser off the hairline?
That seems a bit excessive.
I fancy having that done.
Yeah.
The only thing that they don't really explain is the actual shape of their heads. Because Nicolas Cage has got a very long, thin head.
Yeah.
Yeah, and John Travolta hasn't.
It's a real leap, but you just kind of have to suspend disbelief.
But he's on board with it very quickly.
Yeah, it doesn't take a hell of a lot of convincing. I mean, you'd really have to twist my arm to slice my face off.
I think, be damned, I just moved to the other coast.
Yeah,
and hope the prevailing wind's not that strong. Yeah.
Sorry, suckers. Yeah. It's quite grisly, the procedure, when they actually do the slicing and then they get this little suction thing and sort of soft the skin.
It's good. It's good. But I did notice they actually cut his hair during the operation. They give him a little trim. All that dead hair with open surgery.
God, it'll get itchy when that gets in.
Oh, that's pretty nasty. Yeah. You can get some nasty growths from things like that. Yeah.
But
the operation is a success.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Sean wakes up, of course, with Nicolas Cage's face, he goes, totally Cage bonkers.
Yeah, he goes Cage.
He's just going, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. Yeah. And he's smashing mirrors and chucking stuff about.
Laugh cry.
There's a lot of that too, the laugh crying.
So
they immediately take him to Big Boots prison.
Yeah, well, first there's this quite a sublime moment where it's before they put the microchip on his larynx and you have Nicolas Cage's face talking with John Travolta's voice.
Oh, yeah.
It's just quite a beautiful moment of cinema.
Yeah. Peach. I could eat a peach for hours.
They take him off to the big house, which is, of course, Erewhon prison, which is nowhere kind of backwards.
Which is run by Norm Gunderson.
Yeah, yeah. And the Geneva Convention doesn't exist here. Amnesty International doesn't know it exists. It's basically just kind of like a Guantanamo, but with big moon boots.
Big moon boots and videos of deer.
Calming videos of deer.
But then immediately he sees Pollux, and immediately a prison brawl breaks out. Some guy attacks him, and they're hitting each other with dinner trays.
Yeah. Well, he sees Thomas Jane first, doesn't he?
He does see Thomas Jane, that's right.
Got a bit of a surprise to see him.
Yeah, with some big glasses on him.
So dressed up like David Koresh.
Yeah. then there's a fight with a big man, to which Sean, pretending to be Troy, kicks him in the nuts with those big boots.
Yeah.
And then does the famous, like, laugh crying and shouting, I'm Caster Troy, woo! He does a big woo at the end of it.
Because he can see that Pollux isn't quite buying that it's really Caster. And so he has to go full Troy.
Like you mentioned earlier, the whole direction that the actors would have had was while they were pretending to be the other one, they were supposed to be doing impersonations of them.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously John Travolta does, I think, quite a good Nicolas Cage impression.
Yeah,
he does that punctuation in the wrong place constantly, which is very good. But Cage, he's just not doing it at all. He's not doing Travolta at all. He's just being mad.
I guess because the character of Sean Archer is just such a sanctimonious, boring twat that...
Yeah, it's not much on the page, is there?
No, so when Cage is doing Archer, and Troy's doing Archer, he's just kind of a dull, blank twat.
I suppose he was going from the angle of, I now have the face of the man who killed my son, who I've been obsessed with for the past 6 years. That's driven me a bit mad.
Driven me a bit mad, yeah. Travolta really, he really enjoys himself.
He does. Yeah. It's a pleasure
to
watch.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, Troy's awake. He's not in his turnip state anymore.
No.
He's woken up. And so, of course, the first thing he does is take the bandages off his face and learn that he's got these... His face is just some red mush.
Yeah, they do a shot where he sort of... The fingers go to the viscera and he sort of pulls out like a little bit.
It's like a bit of jam or something he's got.
He makes this real horrible sort of gurgling sound. And
squealing,
And then when he calls his mate on the phone, and you can tell that he's talking, he's like holding his lips.
Yeah, that's right.
Off his gums when he talks.
But he also sounds a bit like Jimmy Stewart. He's going, you come on over here. Come and get me.
Jimmy Stewart.
So they capture the doctor and bring him to the lab. And he says, well, what do you want? And this is another nice bit where it's the reflection of his faceless face in the glasses. And he says, take one goddamn guess.
Yeah, yeah. And it's quite convenient that they do leave Sean Archer's face just sort of flopping about in a bowl.
Yeah. It's not like in a deep freeze, they just put it in a big pint glass.
It's like in a terrarium.
Yeah. So, of course, back in Big Boots prison, Sean, pretending to be Caster, is now talking to Pollux, trying to get the location of where the bomb is. But, of course, he's wondering why that guy attacked him. And this is where Pollux says, it's because you had a sex sandwich with his wife and sister. A sex sandwich?
Yeah.
Is that a sub of the day?
Yeah, I don't know what's so bad about that, just sitting down eating a sandwich with wife and sister.
That sounds quite nice.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, he didn't like it.
No.
So very, very quickly, he leads Pollux into revealing where it is, because he says something along the lines of, like, I guess the convention centre will have to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Mystic Meg.
And then he's like, yeah, you're nicked, mate.
Yeah,
he's
like, you're a prick. Fuck off. Yeah,
fuck
basically.
You. Yeah.
He should have really kept the pretense going just a little bit longer.
Yep. And he thinks he's going to go meet his mate. He's got a visitor and he thinks, yes, I've got the location of the bomb. All right, I can get my face back.
But guess who the visitor is?
Guess who walks in?
It's Sean.
Being very sort of coy with the newspaper.
Oh, he sort of is, like, yes.
Sort of treating like a little fan.
And he sort of says, well, how did this happen? And the newspaper gives it away because the headline is Deadly Inferno at Walsh Institute. Kind of gives it away. And it is deadly. We get a flashback where everyone who knows about the case has all been tied up and had petrol thrown on them. So nobody knows.
He's really fucked now, isn't he?
Yeah, he's in trouble. Yeah. So Castor, pretending to be Sean, goes away and is now living Sean's life.
Mm-hmm.
So he flirts a little bit with Eve.
Yeah.
First thing he does is read her diary.
Yeah.
Which says, we haven't made love in 2 months. I still think that's quite impressive.
I wonder if sort of she just updates it every month or something. We haven't made love in 3 months. We haven't made love in 4 months.
Yeah, he just opened it at a random page.
Yeah.
But he goes to see Rebel Daughter, who's in her room.
He has a bit of an icky moment with her too, though. Sort of like
gets he has a bit of a reach around, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is horrible. But she thinks he's now okay because he smokes.
Mm.
And he says, ow, while listening to James Brown. Which, if you're a teenager and you saw a middle-aged man do that, you'd think, God, he's brilliant.
I wish he was my
he's
dad.
He's brilliant. Yeah. So he goes and disarms the bomb.
Yeah.
And now he's the big hero with the FBI. This time when they clap when he enters the room, he's loving it. He's full of it.
I love the bit with the TV cameras get him after he's just disarmed the bomb and sort of ask if he has any kind of message for the bad guys. And he's interception. Now our side's got the ball. Sorry.
Yeah.
It is.
I did write down one of the things he said. I can't remember where he says it, but it's hilarious where he's questioning someone and he goes, know that. Thank you. Next question. It's just wonderful.
He is really good. There was a period of time where only Travolta could get away with that kind of delivery.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, very small window, but a window.
Yeah, it's well worth it. He sees the window. So he's being all cheeky and cocky and everyone's loving him now. It's got president on line one. Tell the president to hold. I'm talking to my wife.
Yeah, which of course was stark contrast to earlier when Sean Archer had his wife on line one and ignored her to go after Castor Troy.
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, just to complete the fantasy, the next thing he does is seduce Archer's wife.
Mm.
She gets home and he's got loads of candles and enough food to feed an entire restaurant. There's lobster and steak and chips and loads of other cool stuff. But if there's that much food, you're not going to feel randy afterwards.
Not really. You're not going to feel randy. You're not going to feel your wife, Eve. You're not going to feel anyone.
Absolutely not. No, neither. But they do. He takes her upstairs for what I'd imagine would be some tongue-sucking and peach-devouring.
You'd have to hope that they were both kind of, you know, similarly, how can I put this, endowed?
Well, yeah, because they never mentioned that in the operation.
It's not called cock off, is it?
She may have noticed.
Nicolas Cage could have had 3 testicles. I mean, that's why his brother was called Bollocks. But, I guess it's, you know, in that 2 months she just forgot.
Well, yeah. Mm. Yeah, it's like that.
Mm.
How soon they forget. Back in prison, back in Big Boots prison, Sean, dressed as Troy, learns that the only time they take the boots off is when they're in the clinic having electric shock therapy.
Yeah.
So he has to get himself to the clinic. So he starts a fight involving stealing a cigarette and punching a guard or something. He's taken off to that clinic. He manages to escape.
Because the big guy that he had a fight with at the start.
Yeah, Sex Sandwich Man.
Yeah, had just been zapped. And he kind of goads him into beating up the guards and causes a big riot. Fights his way out, gets out onto the roof, and holy shit, he's in a deep sea oil rig.
Yeah.
Which I thought was actually quite a cool little reveal.
Oh, I agree. I think it's great. After running away from some exploding oil drums, he manages to get into the ocean where he's believed to be dead.
Then they tell Troy as Archer. And of course, he's much more cool with his colleagues now as well. He's not a twat. He doesn't just walk in and go, remember Pincus. a colleague tries to hand him a cup of coffee. How can I drink this when Janelli died? So he's really cool and loved by his colleagues now. But of course they come in and let him know that Castor Troy's dead. And then he just loses his fucking shit.
He does.
He loses his shit when he realizes there's no body.
He basically says, he's already here. And he is.
He must have swam a long way. He did sort of like the Pierce Brosnan in Die Another Day. Swims to another fucking city.
Yeah, he does manage to escape. And just to hammer the point home, he phones him up and says, well, if you're Sean Archer, then I guess I'm Castor Troy, which is nice. Because he does have the body of Castor Troy and he knows all of Castor Troy's actions, he goes to see the old gang. He goes to see Dietrich, which is the Nick Cassavetes character, the bald man. And he immediately gives him his Cadbury's favourites box of drugs. And they both knock back this drink that looks a bit like Lemsip.
Well, they might have sort of sore throats from all the laugh crying.
Horse. He's obviously not used to taking very hard drugs, so it hits him immediately.
Yeah.
And this is where he says, I'd like to take his face off.
Yeah.
Did you hear what I said?
Yeah.
I said, I'd like to take his face off.
Yeah.
Repeat.
I've got a really embarrassing confession to make.
Ooh, lovely.
For many years, did not realise that the name of this movie, Face Off, actually referred to a face off. I didn't realise the
it's
double...
It's a clever play on words,
I,
isn't it?
I did not realise the double meaning until quite recently. I just thought it was a really on-the-nose, obvious face off.
Maybe that's why it's not called cock off, because that isn't a double meaning.
Yeah. It was that fucking forward slash that... That got me.
That's okay. Thank you for sharing.
That's all right. The movie for me starts to sag a little bit at this point. Just a little. I mean, it's a nearly 2 hour, 20 minute film, I think.
Yeah, and most of it's slow-mo.
Yeah.
It would have been a 90 minute film if they just cut out some of the slow-mo.
Yeah, 45 minutes if they fast forwarded.
That would have been great. Like an action Benny Hill.
Probably only needed to be, I mean, even 2 hours is long for a movie like this. It could have been 2 hours.
Yeah, there's a few bits that are just there to, they're basically little markers for things that will be used later in the film.
Yeah.
And probably the biggest example is where then Castor Troy, dressed as Sean Archer, attacks Jamie's boyfriend because he's about to assault her, so he beats the shit out of him.
Yeah.
So it's a terrorist attacking a would-be rapist.
Yeah. And then, he does a nice little bit of victim blaming there as well, and he says, if you dress up like Halloween, ghouls will find their way into your pants.
Yeah, if you'd said ghoulies, it would have been funnier. Yeah. But,
but, yeah.
But it's that kind of rebranding of violence, like we talked about in Once Were Warriors.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a horrible, horrible man, but because he's beaten somebody bad up, like, he's all right now, he's cool. Right.
He's cool,
and he is treated as kind of cool in this bit, isn't he? We're supposed to think that Castor Troy's really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
But he does give her one of those knives where you have to do the flicky-flacky moving around bit, just the butterfly knife, yeah. He gives her that and says, you stick it in your leg and twist it. Just in case it's needed later in the film.
Yeah, it's Chekhov's butterfly knife.
Chekhov's butterfly knife, absolutely. But back at Dietrich's house, this is where he reconnects with Sasha, Gina Gershon's character, and we meet her son with crap bowl hair.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a period in the 90s where every small boy had a crap bowl haircut.
They were that sort of kind of shaggy bowl, kind of like Jonathan Taylor Thomas from Home Improvement.
Absolutely,
yeah. Just Hobie from Baywatch.
That's the name I haven't heard for a while.
Well, no one's heard that name because it's not a fucking name. Is it short for Hobias?
Hobias sounds quite nice. So he's having a nice time with Sasha. He's really getting into the role.
Yeah.
He's having a bit of a pash with Sasha.
Sasha the Pasha.
Unfortunately, Pollux has phoned his bro and he tells him that Archer's actually there.
Yeah.
But Archer, as Troy, meets boy with crap hair and does the hand fart thing all over his face. And starts going a bit mad, starts calling him Mikey. And this is when the police attack. There's a hell of a lot of gunfire. There's a lot of shooty-shooty. And a bit that I really liked is where they put the headphones on the little boy's head.
Yeah.
While the gunplay's going on all around. Yeah. And it's Olivia Newton-John singing Over the Rainbow.
Yeah.
Really brilliant.
It's really good. It's a really nice little moment.
It was used a little bit in Kick-Ass, where they played Elvis singing Glory, Glory, Hallelujah.
Yeah. In the final slow-mo shootout.
American Trilogy, yeah. But it's really good.
Yeah. And then they have a cool little Mexican sort of standoff with each other, or kind of a little nice little moment where they're back to back, Troy and Archer, and they decide that they've just got to kill each other, turn around, and they're kind of facing a mirror, and it's quite a quite a cool,
yes,
cool moment.
Yes, but then Pollux gets killed. Of course, they go through a big plate glass roof.
Yeah,
and they fall and fall and fall, and Pollux dies.
Because even John Woo by that point was bloody sick of his performance.
Yeah, just get rid of him. So yeah. He's dead.
Yeah.
But then back at the FBI office, Victor, who is Sean's boss.
Victor Lazaro.
Victor Lazaro. He's in Fargo, isn't he?
Yeah, he's in a few things. Harv Presnell?
Harv Presnell, yeah, that's him.
He's good. He's got a big, proud moustache.
And a very gruff voice, like this.
Yeah.
But he says to Sean that even though he's the current poster boy, he doesn't like his maverick-style antics.
Yeah.
So John Travolta just kills him with a judo chop.
He sort of does a Roger Moore kind of judo chop. Sort of donkey punches him and then just kind of bashes his chest. And yeah, he gone.
He gone, yeah. And this is where Nicolas Cage breaks into the Archer house. Naturally, Eve doesn't believe that it's Sean. She thinks it's Castor Troy.
Yeah.
And this would have been the point where he could have done the hand fart thing and that would have convinced her, but he doesn't do it.
Maybe he hadn't eaten that day, just couldn't get one going.
might have had skiddies and it would have been a bit too much. A big brown smear down her face.
Yeah, pulled his hand out, it was like a big glob of Nutella on it.
A Vegemite sex sandwich. But he says, well, there's one way to believe me. We've got different blood types and conveniently you're a doctor. So you can go and do some blood tests. And she realises Zig's right. And of course she says, oh my God.
Yeah.
She knows that he's telling the truth.
Yeah.
And this is when he does hand face.
Yeah.
And goes, see, he told you.
Why didn't you do that before, you idiot?
This then moves on because Victor Lazaro's dead. The final face-off will take place at his memorial service, which is a lovely church on the beach.
It is.
Very nice.
It is. Really handily sets up another big set piece.
And of course the church is full of doves.
Mm.
Of course.
Yeah. John Woo has shares in a dove company.
Makes very nice deodorant. But this is the big ending because Sean Archer, dressed as Castor Troy, has recruited Gina Gershon to be on his side. And so there's a big challenge. He lets John Travolta know that he's on his case by giving him a photo of Mikey, just to let him know that I'm here and I'm coming for you. And so there's some slow-mo gunplay, but he's got Eve. And then about five people walk in, and they're all just pointing guns randomly. I have no idea who's pointing guns at whom.
Yeah.
It's very hard to work out, especially then because it just goes shooty, 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 and there's people just spinning around and doing that thing where they got one arm pointing behind them and one the other way, and they're doing those funny little flips for no reason onto their backs and stuff like that. It's all kicking off.
Seems very impractical, really, doesn't it, when you're diving onto your back when you've got a gun?
Well, yeah.
Because then you've got to get back
up. Because you've got to line just right. Yeah. Just stay standing up or crouch on one knee, maybe.
Takes me 2 minutes to get up from a lying down position these days.
Oh, I can't get up. I'm like a turtle. I can't do it. It's very difficult. But the other thing I thought is, for people who desperately want their own faces back, they're in a hell of a hurry to shoot them off.
They really are. They're not taking very good care of each other's faces.
Quite careless.
Mm.
But this, of course, is when Jamie, rebel teenage daughter, turns up and Castor, dressed as Archer, holds her hostage. But as luck would have it, some people say you bring a gun to a knife fight. She brings a knife to a funeral.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she stabs him in the leg and twists it.
It's quite a good moment. I mean, it was predictable, but it pays off nicely.
And then we have this very long boat chase.
I quite liked it. Bellisic sort of jet boat
violence.
And actually quite a nicely cathartic final showdown as well. It actually reminded me a little bit of the final fight in Mission Impossible 2 that Woo does when Doug Ray Scott and...
Oh, the motorbike fight or...
Which goes on for like 45 minutes. But then they end up having that scrap on the beach. It was good. And when he actually finally harpoons Travolta, and which isn't a prison analogy, but when he...
Gonna harpoon you good.
When he finally kills him and then just kind of lets out that, die, die.
Yeah.
Die. Yeah. There's a lot of shouting, really, doesn't he?
Yeah, but the feds turn up and they immediately believe Eve's story.
Yeah.
That... Oh, this man has nicked my husband's face. It's not really Castor Troy.
Yeah.
You must believe me.
Yeah, look, here's some blood. Look. Oh, okay. Oh,
yeah, that's right. I've got some blood.
Makes sense to me.
But she says, it's okay. Yeah, we're bringing in the top surgical team from DC. Bearing in mind, everyone who knew about this procedure is dead.
Yeah.
Who are this top surgical team? We want you to take his face off and put it on there. Nah, sorry. I could do an appendix. But they do. So even though all the notes, the research, the equipment and the personnel have all been destroyed, they can still do it, which is pretty lucky, really.
And those amazing sort of surgical lasers which leave zero scarring around the...
And they can make the hair grow back. And then we have a final scene, which I thought was so offensive, it nearly derails the entire film. Well, first of all, we see Jamie. She gets face thingied again.
Yeah.
And thankfully, she's shaken off all her sort of personal expression and individuality.
Yeah.
Thank fuck, she's now wearing a beige cardigan.
Mm.
Thank God for that.
That's how
she's
we
as
want
boring
her.
As everybody else. Yeah.
She was cool when she was before.
She was herself. It was fine. Was... There's nothing wrong with that at all. Sean turns up and he's brought Eve a gift. He's brought a replacement son that looks exactly like the dead one.
Well,
and she effectively goes, oh, can we keep him?
It may as well have just been a little robot, Haley Joel Osment from AI. I mean...
It's like when your goldfish dies
and
they try and sneak in another one from the pet shop and hope nobody notices.
Yeah.
I thought it was horrible.
It does miss the mark. And they were obviously going for some of that kind of symmetry thing of, you know, you took my son... Now I'm having your son, we're kind of the same. You know, that kind of whole Gemini kind of...
But that's not a basis for a family, stealing somebody's son.
No.
And again, effectively just to replace yours.
Some pretty complicated home truths are going to come out in that boy's life later. So where's my real dad? Oh, I swapped faces with him and then killed him. Yeah.
I killed him, yeah.
Do I have a brother? Well, your
this real
dad
this
killed
kid,
him.
He looks a bit like me.
Yeah.
Now he's dead. Your dad killed him.
Your
and
dad
just got
him.
You because you look a bit like him.
Yeah.
Do you mind if we call you Michael?
They tried to sort of shoehorn in what they thought was a nice ending,
so
but it was a bit icky. I agree.
Very bad taste. But just to cement very bad taste, John Travolta's obviously done a massive eggy guff because he rubs his hand over new son's face.
Let me wipe that Castor-Troy stink off you and put my stink on you.
If you didn't think it was bad enough that your dad's a murderer and I killed him, sniff this. A Scientologist's fart.
Lord Xenu's guesses.
Look who's farting too.
Yeah, here's some grease.
I think we should just cut to the chase. Robert Forward / Johnson. Is Face Off still any good?
Yeah, I thought it was good. I really enjoyed it. There was a couple of moments, I think, when Nicolas Cage goes back to his old gang HQ where it just started to slightly sag for me. But there were those kind of necessary little pauses between all the bombastic violence.
Mm.
I thought it was great. It was Cage and Travolta at the peak of their hammy powers. It was a high concept. These days, if you made a film like that, they'd try and turn it into a trilogy, or they would try and franchise
it. It'd be an origin story, yeah.
Yeah, and it just was a standalone, really, it's a really original action movie with some really good performances centering it, characters that you kind of actually rooted for. It was an interesting kind of concept, seeing them kind of, after you watch a scene, you kind of revisit it going, well, actually, that's Travolta playing Cage playing Travolta, kind
yes.
of.
Yes, yeah.
So, you know, I'd probably be quite content not to watch it again for another 15 years, but it's the sort of thing that I'd chuck on for my kid when they're 10 or 11 or 12. Thought it was good fun.
Fun is the word. It never, ever stops being fun. Everything that we've watched, which is now over 40 films.
Wow.
I think this is just about the most fun film that I've watched for this.
Yeah.
I didn't think it sagged as much as you did. It was a very long running time, but there's always a set piece around the corner which is just bombastic and ridiculous and a good laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
The fun, of course, is in the fact that they're trying to do these impersonations of each other and it's so over the top. And the performances are just bonkers, other than the horrendous ending, which I could really have done without. Yeah, I thought it was fab.
And you watch it and you do remember why they were sort of kings of the screen for a period of time there.
Oh, completely. You know? It sounds like a real cliche, but they don't make them like this anymore.
No, they don't.
Action films these days have their tongue so far in their cheek, they have The Rock running around looking surprised and having a bit of, you know, we'll all have a big laugh. Or it takes itself far too seriously. It would be dark and it would be, you know, it would be miserable and maudlin.
Yeah.
This is just a good laugh. It's so entertaining.
Yeah. I really hope they don't try and redo this because, like you say, it'll be turned into something absolutely anodyne with Chris Pratt and The Rock. Or, like you say, it'll be turned into just something really grim and horrible.
Yeah. it would have Tom Hardy someone similar in it.
Yeah.
But did you see, interestingly enough, I see that Cage and Travolta weren't the first choice to play these two characters. Some of the pairs they considered were
Sly
Stallone, Arnie. Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
Bodies would have been a bit of a problem there. And apparently De Niro and Pacino.
Yeah, well, De Niro and Pacino, that would have been interesting.
That would kind of work.
That would have worked. It would have been, you can kind of imagine it being more of a, maybe a more of a hard-boiled gangster edge to it.
Mm.
I also read that Harrison Ford and, God, who else was it? Someone like that, or Harrison Ford and Michael Douglas? No, Harrison, which again, that would have been really interesting. Yeah, these are things that you just wouldn't get these days. You wouldn't get interesting character actors put forward for.
I tell you what would work these days to make it really lighthearted is if the terrorist was a man and the FBI agent was a woman. That would raise some laughs. So you have it as like Steve Carell and Kristen Wiig or something like that.
Jennifer Aniston and. So you have Steve Carell's face CGI'd onto Kirsten Wiig's body. Yeah. Sounds like the plot of a Wayans Brothers film.
Well, it sounds a bit like All of Me with Steve Martin.
Yeah, or Adam Sandler playing.
Adam Sandler playing both.
Playing both, yeah.
That's Netflix, if you're listening. So, I think in conclusion, yes, I thought it was still good.
Well, I'm happy about that, because it's always nice when we devote 2 hours and 20 minutes to something good. Well, Chris, then your choice next. What have you got for us?
Well, because what we've just seen does sort of play with duality and different realities, and it is a beautiful love story at the heart of Face Off, I thought I'd have something in a similar vein. So I've gone for a romantic comedy from the mid-90s, which does involve two separate realities. Very, very high concept. So, Rob, we're going to watch Sliding Doors.
Wow.
Now, I'm not just doing this cynically. I did enjoy it at the time. My girlfriend at the time went to see this at the movies and we enjoyed it enormously.
Yeah.
I think I may have only seen it once ever since then and still kind of liked it. It's one that is talked about quite a lot
as
a popular romantic comedy from that era. Gwyneth Paltrow doing her plummy English accent.
Yeah.
So I am keen to see how it's held up after all this time. And I'm sure you are too.
Oh, well, I wouldn't say that, but, I'll... I will dutifully watch it, as is the life of Chosen. Yeah, I've only seen this once. I saw it when it came out on new release. I think I kind of was mildly entertained. But yeah, that must have been about 20 something years ago now.
You're so, older and more mature now, so I'm sure you'll appreciate it much more.
I will. I have more life experiences to look back on now. more sliding doors that I perhaps should have slammed shut.
That's right. More of a what could have been kind of moment. So yeah, I think we'll find it really relatable.
Probably more of, oh, that shouldn't have been. But yeah.
Might have a few of those too, yeah. Okay, I think it's probably time to wrap it up, so we'll do our usual housekeeping. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do on Twitter at Still Any Good Pod.
Instagram, Still Any Good Pod.
We're also on Facebook, Still Any Good. And if you want to email us, you can do stillanygood@gmail.com.
And please do subscribe and please do rate and review us. We love getting your feedback and your comments.
Yes, please. That would be very, very nice. On that note, I think it's time to say goodnight.
Good night.
Good night, folks. See you soon. Bye.